really interesting. My guest is Robert Hooks. You may know him as an actor on stage and screen, also been on television. He's had an amazing career. One of the members of the Academy that reviews films, votes on them. He's sort of an elder statesman of Hollywood, but he's also done a whole lot more than that, and most of that is not known to the general public, even, I think, to fans of Robert Hooks. We talked, Robert, about the things that you feel are your legacy, your contributions to Black culture and the theater movement, your discussions with Martin Luther King about how to help move that forward, creating opportunities for other communities and people and artists that might not otherwise have those opportunities because they're economically or socially disadvantaged. You've participated in creating tuition-free training programs, and you've been a producer, you've been a director, you've been an actor, you've created theater companies, several of which are still important and still existing and doing shows. So you've done quite a lot of stuff, Robert.
Well, yes, Mike. I've been around the block a few times, a few decades. I had the opportunity just to be one of the first actors that was able to parlay a Broadway stage career into film and television rather successfully. I've been very, very busy as a performer, as an actor, and I've done that, made my mark there. I used that celebrity, that leverage, not to beat my chest that I've been a successful performer, successful actor, some say star, celebrity, and all that. That's fine. But that doesn't, I mean, it's important, and it allowed me to do the real, true, heartfelt things with my career. And so my success as an actor in front of the camera on all levels, you know, film, television, and, you know, have you. But so that allowed me to really do create opportunities for others in the industry. And the industry, look, has not been in our favor for actually all of my career. And I was, you know, I've always been of a mind, if you have some kind of leverage, then use that leverage to do something for others. Use that leverage to open doors for others. Use that leverage to kind of set up in the different cities around the country cultural institutions that mean something to not just the Black community, but for all of the community where that particular cultural institution is set.
Well, it's so, another version of doing well by doing good, by having a career that enables you to accomplish some actual dreams.
Yeah, and I would hope that a lot of people would do that. And our problem has been, when I say our, I mean the Black community's problem, has been that those people that have gone on to success, tremendous success in several cases, you know, are not really giving back what I think they should be giving. And now, a lot of them are giving back, don't get me wrong. But I just think we can do so much more creating opportunities in the community and for those artists that don't have the wherewithal to go to college or to afford this institution or that institution, but to create something in the community for those people. And that's where I think we are not strong enough.
Now, a little history. You were actually born in Washington, D.C., which a lot of people don't think of you as a Washingtonian. You were even saying that a lot of people seem to think that you come from Philadelphia. So where did people get that impression where you actually lived in D.C. until you were about 15? It's not like you left as a baby.
Yeah, exactly. I left, I guess I was around 15, going on 16 when I left D.C. But no, Washington, D.C., as a matter of fact, the Foggy Bottom of Washington, D.C. is where I was born and raised. And the Foggy Bottom now, of course, is not what it was then. The Foggy Bottom now is very chic. The State Department is there, whatever. But when I was born and raised in the foggy bottom. It was truly a foggy and very bottom. And so that's where I'm from. But then, you know, my mother remarried after my father died, and she remarried into another, you know, a gentleman who had his family. And so we moved to Philadelphia. And so most people know me, of course, you know, my high school, and then that's when I got serious about acting. And so we reflect back to Philadelphia, my seeing the Broadway plays in Philadelphia. So I think that's why people identify me with Philadelphia, because that's where my career actually started. But no, I'm from Washington, D.C. proudly. And as a matter of fact, just came back from a Robert Hooks Day in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, let's talk about that. That was a celebration of the D.C. Black Repertory Company, which was founded by you, I believe, in 1970, always with some help, but I believe you're the basic founder.
It was my concept, and you know, I had no help. I had help on the Negro Ensemble Company, but I had no help here, and I didn't need it. I mean, I was ready to start another theater company.
And they basically had, in Washington, D.C., earlier this year, they had a Robert Hooks Day.
Just a few weeks ago, as a matter of fact.
So
Mike,
cool.
It was the 47th anniversary of the D.C. Black Rep, and they wanted to honor the founder, myself, and then those people that I brought around me to launch the company in the artistic fashion. So the honoring ceremony, which was in October the 18th, I believe it was, honored those people. I think about 13 or 14 people, including myself, were honored by the city for being able to be successful with this cultural institution that I brought to town, and I brought it to town for a very, very personal reason, too.
What was that?
Well, I got a call once from the mayor asking, it was right after Martin Luther King was shot, there were riots that broke out in over 100 cities around the country, but Washington, D.C., my hometown, was burning to the ground, and they called me, the mayor called me, I'm sure he called a lot of other people too, but called me and asked me if I could come down to Washington from New York, which is where I was working and living, and come down and help quell this riot and give these people some hope to come back from the burning, smoldering of the city itself. So I did. The next day went down, and I saw my town, my city, my hometown burning to the ground. And I did what they asked me to do, but then on my way back to the train station to come back to New York, because I was doing a TV series and a Broadway play at that time.
Oh.
So I thought, well, I know what I can do for the city to start the healing after this riot, the destruction of the city. And so I decided I got back to New York and decided that I would go back home and build an institution just like we had in New York, the Negro Ensemble Company, for the city of Washington. And so I did. I closed up shop. Didn't close up shop. I handed it over to Douglas and Jerry and moved to Washington, D.C., right in the middle of a successful career, mind you.
Yeah.
Moved back to live and to build this cultural institution.
Now, you had to drop out of a theater production, I guess, to do this.
No, I was actually doing, well, I was doing...
You were commuting?
NYPD. No, to start the company, to move back. I had, the show, the television series, NYPD...
Which was a great series.
...was over at the time. So I was able to, I was able to then move back to Washington to build this new company of mine. And so the anniversary, and that was 47 years ago, the anniversary, which was a celebration, just happened, and it was a fantastic event. Well, two events, actually. And, there was a Robert Hooks Day, and, you know, they gave me this great, great painting and honors. It was a wonderful feeling to go back home to my hometown and to be thanked. I mean, what I did was, I took my own career and put it on hold and went back, and I did this. And it was successful, Mike. It was very successful. The president of the United States invited me to the White House.
Richard Nixon.
Hometown boy comes home to do something for the community kind of thing. And Jack Valenti, who was a member of the of AMPUS at the time, he was there, and he was a friend. And so, and then they also introduced me from the House, from the floor of the House, Congressman Perrin Mitchell. And it was all about me coming back home to do what needed to be done to help heal this community that was just completely destroyed.
Now, tell me, I think it's interesting. Most people would not think of starting a theater company as being a socially significant community contribution. I mean, it's not the first thing that pops to mind. Usually it's redevelopment, it's jobs, it's money, it's this, it's that.
Right.
Tell me about the thinking and implementation of starting a theater company as a way of helping to heal a city.
Well, let me just take you and the audience back to New York, where we started the Negro Ensemble Company, the three of us. It became a national treasure, big success, and I saw how the audience building, we had audience people that had never seen theater before come to the theater and become theater goers, learning what these incredible writers were writing about. So our audience building situation at the Negro Ensemble Company was instilled in my brain when I came up with the concept for Washington, D.C., because I saw it happen. I saw people coming closer together under one roof in this theater where we had all these great playwrights and we had wonderful artistic people coming in to direct and choreograph and dance and sing and, you know, so that, I saw that firsthand. I was involved in creating that. So I knew that's exactly what Washington needed when I saw this city of mine smoldering, and I thought, how can I help? Well, I do this very well. I start institutions very well. I've done it three times, and I've been responsible for helping others do it many, many more times. So I knew that I could do that, and I knew that's what the city needed. And let's face it, culture, entertainment, plays, people coming in to see dance companies, and then also I knew the training aspect of this new company in Washington would help the communities, the young kids in the community kids that might want to write or direct or act or sing. I had to have a component of the company, like my New York company, that was a tuition-free component opened up to those students or those youngsters in the community. Of course, they had to come in and, you know, and audition and
sure.
pass their audition.
Right.
But they would have no other place to go if it were not for a D.C. Black Repertory Company or a Negro Ensemble Company or a group theater workshop.
Okay, let me do a quick station ID, if I may.
I can do it, and I did it.
Thank you. Let me do a quick station ID. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. You can go to kpft.org and see what's going on at the station, various events, opportunities in the studio itself. You can, of course, donate to KPFT and help keep us on the air. We're a community-supported station. Just click on the donate link. You can also go to my website, thinkwingradio.com, and see all the different shows and articles and links and various other things that I put on that site. And I'm a little edgier on Twitter at Think Wing Radio because, you know, it's not radio. It's just Twitter. Okay, so my guest today is Robert Hooks, actor, director, producer, theater company founder. I suppose, I don't know that you like the term, but civil rights activist, activist for black culture, minority culture, communities.
All those fit, Mike. I mean, I was involved in the civil rights movement, and I brought culture to the beginning of that. So all of those things you can add on to whatever, you know. I mean, I was there. Fortunately, I was there during the period, the height of the civil rights movement. I had a great kind of, it was great, but I had a quandary because I wanted to be more involved in the civil rights movement, but my acting career was just moving great guns.
Yeah.
And I was on Broadway. I mean, I'd done, what, 8 Broadway plays. So I was going, and this is all during the 60s, during the decade of the 60s. And I was still able to, because of, you know, my emotion and feelings about the community, I was able to use my leverage to still work and create opportunities and theater cultural institutions.
Now, I there's one thing I want to get back to, because there is a fraction of American society that feels that cultural endeavors like theater and symphonies and art, they don't see economic value, they don't see societal value, and yet this was an area that you focused on in order to help to build neighborhoods and communities and enrich them. Can you explain to the folks that don't think that such things are worth funding or worth doing why you felt that was so important and how you felt that it improved the lives of the people around this theater company?
Yeah, well, I think that culture is probably vital, not probably, but is a vital part of the growth of any individual, regardless of what they want to do. You have to know your culture. You have to understand the people that came before you that created art and culture. You have to know about that. And if you learn about that, then all of a sudden that could trigger something in you. And look, the money part of it, Mike, look, we were a nonprofit organization. You know that. You work for one.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I think that's nonprofit.
501c3.
Yeah, 501c3, which is what you have to have if you're going to build something in the community, because that's the only time people will make donations is when you're doing something positive for the community. Money, look, if you do a good play, you make do a great box office thing. If you do 5 good plays during the course of the season, you may be able to meet your overhead, but that's not what it's all about. It's not about that. It's about creating opportunities, not just for the audiences to come in and see the people that look like them in stories that they know about for the first time.
Yeah, that's an important component that a lot of people don't understand, that when you watch a story, it helps to see people that look like you or are ethnically like you, whether it's about them particularly or whether they're an admixture into the story, parts that really should be colorblind that are not cast that way.
There's a
lot of movement that needs to be done. I've come to understand over the years that when I read a synopsis for a story, it's like, this is a very male-oriented story. All the action is about men. Most of the cast is men. The women are kind of accessories to the story. That must be annoying.
Well, it is annoying, and it was the same. It is the same discrimination factor that blacks feel when they're denied the opportunities to even audition for certain roles. Well, women as well. I mean, I think that, but I do think that what's happening now with the women's movement that over the last decade or so has taken flight, actually. Look at Congress. Look at the many,
yeah, that's
many
amazing.
Women now in Congress. And I think that Hollywood has to feel that, and all the other professions have to feel it. But I'm in the entertainment industry, and, you know, my problem has always been fair participation for minority, and not just black, but, you know, Asians and Hispanics as well.
Talented people of all groups.
And Native Americans as well.
Yeah.
So I'm about that. I'm about creating opportunities to open doors for those, for that segment of American society. And because it's been what my life has been about. And, you know, my memoir, which will hopefully be coming out sometime in the next year or so, is called More Than Myself. And that's the story of my life. It's always been more than myself. But I've been very fortunate in that I hope I'm a good actor. So they hired me to act in movies. And Otto Perlmutter.
I've always enjoyed your work, Robert.
The very first black actor whose name was above the title of the movie.
You've been called the first black leading man.
I'm sorry?
You've been called, I think, the first black leading man in modern film.
Well, I think Sidney Poitier was the first, you know, black leading man that everybody knows about. Now, I was a leading man, but, I wasn't as famous, needless to say. But, no, my point is that, the movies that that we're talking about, I was talking about Otto Preminger, and it was the movie was Hurry Sundown.
Mm-hmm.
It was Diane Carroll and I were two of the six stars in the movie. And all of the stars' names were above the title, which was a first. Even Sidney Poitier never had that.
Right.
Where the actors' names are above the title of the movies. Now, you know, Henry Fonda and those guys, they always did that. But the first black actor whose name was above the title of a movie was Hurry Sundown. It was me and Jane and Diane Carroll.
That must have been amazing.
It was. It was an amazing experience, too, I can tell you that. Michael Caine, the great actor, English actor, writes in his book about the episode of Hurry Sundown that we shot in the Deep South, and I write about it in my memoir as well. I think Jane wrote about it in her memoir as well, Jane Fonda. But that was a great experience.
How is something like that determined, whether a name goes above or below the title? I mean, is that negotiated by agents? Is that decided by the director?
It depends. Otto Preminger was one of the top Hollywood producers, directors. But he was a very powerful man in the industry. So he could do pretty much anything he wanted to do. Now, no other producer had done it or had even had the thought about doing it. But Preminger, who had a thing for doing a black subject matter anyway, and also had a thing for black women, but he was an amazing man. A lot of people misunderstood him. I had fun with him after I had a confrontation with him, and he realized that he couldn't yell at me and get away with it kind of thing. But Otto Preminger had the power to do it. Now, normally, in answer to your question, it's what the agent is able to negotiate for their clients. It's a lot of things that have to do with the sausage making of the industry and the control. But if a producer like Otto Preminger wanted to put somebody's name above the title, in this case, six very, very talented actors. A lot of them had never had their name over a title, and this was the first for them as well. But Otto did it because Otto Preminger was Otto Preminger.
Right. As a result of the theater company, a number of black actors that became very prominent in the industry got their breaks, I believe. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. Look at the top movie star, leading man in Hollywood, Denzel Washington, got his first play out of the Negro Ensemble Company and was recruited from that play to star in a soldier's play, the movie that was so wonderful that he was in. And then his career just went right through the roof. But then right. Samuel L. Jackson is the same thing. Felicia Rashad, the same thing. There are so many actors who have gone on to enter the entertainment industry and become very successful, having come through the companies that I started.
Must be an enormous source of joy for you.
Well, it is. I mean, you want to feel like your father, and these are, I mean, like when my son Kevin, who is very successful in the industry, I mean, I sit back like a proud father watching Kevin do his thing, and I do the same when I watch Denzel and all the other people that I know came through the Negro Ensemble Company, and their careers would not be as successful as they are had it not been for the Negro Ensemble Company. Now, that's not to say that Denzel Washington would not have been a famous actor, but he got his start at the Negro Ensemble Company.
Well, as they say, luck is preparation meeting opportunity.
Right, exactly. So anyway, it's like a proud father. You sit back and you watch, and you say, oh, wow, okay, I remember when they were on stage struggling for their lines, you know. And all of a sudden now, you know, I mean, this guy's demanding $25 million a movie, you know. That's success.
I guess it's sort of a fan question. What would be the favorite show that you've done or episode, the favorite film that you've done, and the favorite play that you've done?
Well, that's a tough one, but
I figured it would be a tough one.
I've done a lot of wonderful, wonderful roles.
Yeah, there's a long work bio for you, so I know this is going to be a tough question.
Well, yeah, a lot of stuff. Well, look, I've been doing it for over 60 years, Mike, so, you know. But if I had to choose a role that I have done, and I've done hundreds of roles, if I had to choose one role that really, really satisfied me and turned me on, and the creative juices were always there from the time the curtain went up until the time the curtain went down or I left the stage, and that would be a play that I did off-Broadway called The Blacks. It's a play by a French writer, Jean Genet, and a great play, and it ran forever off-Broadway in New York. I mean, I was in and out of it three times. I would be in the play, and then I would get a movie, and I'd go do the movie, and you'd come back, and normally producers would not let the actors come back into the plays. They have their understudies, they have right. other actors. But in The Blacks, the producer was so enamored and wonderful with the people that he was around that he said, if you go off and do a movie, you can always come back. Doors wide open, and if your understudy doesn't understand it, that's his problem. But that play and the role in that play that I played, the character's name was Deodatus Village for short, and he had some great scenes. James Earl Jones did the original. I replaced him in the play, and my village was completely different from his village.
I'll bet.
That's just an actor's thing.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the role that was probably the best role, the most satisfying role for me as an artist in that play. Now, I've done lots of play, A Raisin in the Sun. I mean, I've done a lot of plays where I've played wonderful roles, and but the play is one of my favorite plays. Very, very, very difficult play to kind of comprehend because it's about colonialism, and it's done in whiteface, and it's done not all in whiteface.
That's interesting.
It's called The Clown Show, really, but it really isn't. It's a great drama with lots of wonderful things happening in it. And that character that I played, Village, gave me the opportunity because it's one of those plays where actors could just improvise things on stage that you couldn't do in an ordinary structured play.
Right.
So I got a chance to do some special stuff, and one of them was with Coretta Scott King when Martin Luther King and Coretta came to see the play. I used her in one of my scenes and was blown away that she was right with me all the time. And Martin was sitting next to her looking at me and looking at her and smiling, but I didn't think it was smiling all the time. And it was wonderful. It was a wonderful thing. But that was the character that I was doing.
That had to be a really cool memory.
It was a wonderful experience for me that night, I can tell you that. And we also had a chance to sit down and talk with Martin. And he encouraged me to do exactly what I was doing, building companies and working in the community, and he encouraged me to do that.
Okay, we're going to do a quick break here. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. My guest is actor, producer, director, theater company founder, DC Day honoree, Robert Hooks. You can go to kpft.org and follow the station and listen to archive programming, as well as support the station by hitting the donate button. My website is thinkwingradio.com. I can be followed on Twitter at thinkwingradio. Very original, right? And we are back with Robert Hooks. So I think at this point now, I would like to talk a little, if you would, about how you feel the industry and perhaps, if you wish, the country is moving in terms of equal opportunity, equal billing, for that matter, when it comes to something like theater, opportunity in your fields. What do you think our current situation is now?
Well, let me just go back for a second to kind of make a point about what I think is important in the community. Of course, as I said, was the cultural kind of thing. Now, what happened back in the 60s, whatever happened when the Republicans take over control of Congress, they inevitably cut the legs out from under the National Endowment for the Arts and all of the different grants that go into the communities to build.
Which goes back to my question about the value that some people fail to see in the arts. That's kind of why I asked that.
Yeah, and so it's always been tough until such time as they're not in power. Then when they're not in power, then the whole kind of liberal thinking comes back to the community. And so you have the NEA, the National Endowment for the Arts, smoking again, doing all kinds of wonderful things for the community. But as soon as they lose that power in Congress, then, you know, I don't have to tell you, you know, you're a politico and you talk about it all the time on your show. The control, whoever controls the money, and fortunately, thank God, the Democrats are going to come back next month.
Actually, this week.
Next week.
This week.
Control, right, and be in control of the House, because there's so much repair that needs to be done that has happened.
You know, they're swamped with job applications.
Oh my God.
It's like a
and
great time to be a lawyer.
You gotta mention swamp. That's what we're going to try to clean up.
Yes, yes. So I imagine in the arts, when you have this pendulum swing politically and financially, how hard does that hurt these efforts?
How hard does that hurt? I lost the last part.
This pendulum swing in terms of
right.
funding, not funding.
It hurts. It hurts, Mike. It hurts because you can't do anything in this country if you're in the community. You can't do anything without the government. You know, the government's assistance, and that's always been the problem, is that the legs are cut out. But I already said that. You asked another question about where we are today.
Right.
I kind of lost track when I went back to the real problems.
Yeah, and I guess the question is, to what extent has it changed? To what extent has it not changed? To what extent have old problems gone away and new problems arisen? What is your take on
Well, I'll tell you what I feel about the industry. Look, I think that there's a glimpse of promise in correcting the problems that have happened with casting, of hiring. I don't see enough black writers writing stories for film and television. The stories that are written about black people, it's hard to even get black writers on those shows. And I'd like to see more more people in the industry, in the decision-making areas. Diversity is still a problem in my industry, the entertainment industry. And do I see some progress? Yes, I do. I see progress for African-American artists to a point. But the only reason that that's happening is because of the success of people like Oprah and, you know, the Tyler Perry, the people that now have some leverage to correct the problems of the lack of presentation. So I'm happy to see that, but there's not enough, Mike. It's not enough. I would love very much to see more, you know, I mean, I take my hat off to Oprah and to the people that are doing it, and there are people that are blacks who are African Americans who have their own companies, and they have the creative ability to control what they put out into the public. That's great. That's wonderful. That's progress, because we didn't have an Oprah Winfrey when I was coming up in the 60s and fighting for representation of image, especially image. Now the image is being fixed. Because you have people like Oprah, and I say Oprah, Ava DuVernay, the black creators that have power to call the shots themselves and not have the suits looking over their shoulders, telling them they can't do this, they can't do that.
Let me ask you a question. You talked about how there are shows written for black characters that are written by white writers. That's not wrong.
It's not wrong at all.
To what do you attribute that? Is it a lack of imagination on the parts of the producers that hire them? Is it racism? Is it a lack of sophisticated talent? I mean, what is it?
It's a combination of all those things, really. I mean, you know, like the writers, look, there are a lot of very talented black writers in the industry, but most of them, I would say 90% or more, are white writers, and a lot of them are writers that are established. So when a producer wants to produce a television series, he's going to go after writers who are established and not necessarily new writers. They would be smart to go with new writers, and some of them do, but a lot of times they're not African Americans or other minorities. They're usually white guys who are, you know, I have nothing against any writer that wants to write. Some of my best friends are white. But the point of the lack of opportunities, lack of creative thinking on the part of the decision makers in the industry, all of the industry. I'm talking about now the streaming. I'm talking about cable. I'm talking about network. I'm talking about films, Hollywood. They're just not still, even after all of these decades that have come down, and we've been protesting and sometimes even, you know, picketing. It's still a problem, and that problem will be solved, I think, once those people of color who are very, very successful are a little more active in building outlets.
Is it a generational thing? Do you think it's just a matter of one generation dying off and another generation coming up and being more open?
It's a generational thing, and I think the new generation, my kids and their kids, are of a whole other mindset. And even though my son is from, you know, a black community, his son is, you know, he raised his son, and, you know, they've gone to, you know, great schools, and they've not been exposed to the things that we were exposed to. So, yeah, there is a generational thing. So it's up to those people of my generation who are now tremendously successful to think about using their leverage. I don't necessarily mean their money, you know, because that's the first thing they do. They won't answer your phone calls because they think you want their money. Well, it's not the money that I want from these successful black professionals. It's their name. It's their ability to come in and take off the coat and some, you know, a little of their own, you know.
It's basically using the star power. Star power has intrinsic value.
Yeah, and if they want to invest money, that's fine too, you know, because they do it through, you know, and they can write it off their income tax. So, but it's not, that's not why I want to talk to these people. That's not, when I say these people, I mean the successful black professionals that I have been trying to, over the decades, trying to get in one room and talk about a coalition of success stories. To create new opportunities and to create a black film studio here in Hollywood. And I don't mean a film studio just doing black material. I mean a black-owned and operated film company like Warner Brothers and Fox and Paramount and those companies, but doing all kinds of things.
Have there been efforts to do that? Like you've got BET, the guy who started the Black Entertainment Television. Oprah, of course, has a network, but I think it's a little bit more tuned to the general viewership, perhaps.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that. It's a business decision.
That's what I'm talking about, though. I mean, the stuff Oprah's doing, I'm happy that Oprah and the other, you know, blacks who are in a position to create companies and do properties and do film and so that's great. That's wonderful. That's not what I'm talking about, though. What I'm talking about is building something special, and not for me. I mean, Oprah has a company. It's called OWN, Oprah Winfrey Network, and whatever. That's fine. I'm talking about something else. I'm talking about a big thrust like a Paramount or a Universal that has that kind of outreach on all those levels of distribution and all that. And I think it can be done.
Would it be fair to sort of compare it to the creation of United Artists?
Yes. Exactly.
Where you would have several very powerful minority performers come together and essentially form a company like United Artists, driven by the star power of, I forget who it was at the time, it was like Errol Flynn and Charlie.
Well, it was Douglas Fairbanks Jr., it was Charlie Chaplin, and but see, that's what I'm talking about. They got together in a room, and they said, we are successful. Let's do something and not have to worry about the studios looking over our shoulders or whatever. So they started this. I'm talking about, in this day and age, that approach, but on a much, much larger scale, Mike, because it's a different time. The money is different. I mean, the people I'm talking about bringing together in one room, we're talking about, we're talking about a major studio, not just a boutique a film company. I'm talking about a major studio that's producing television, movies, streaming, doing all kinds of stuff, just like Universal. I think that can be done. I'm happy to see the beginnings of it in Oprah and Tyler Perry and people like that, and now Ava DuVernay is building her. She's just got a contract for one of the networks, and that's great. I'm happy for that. But I'm talking about a coalition. I'm talking about a lot of very, very wealthy people sitting down in a conference room in Magic Johnson's office up in Hollywood, sitting down and coming into an agreement of a coalition, coming together, using their power to build a studio that can have the kind of impact that the big studios in this town have. And I think it's possible, and that's my dream, to be able to at least start the wheels in motion.
How can something like that...
I wasn't kidding.
No, what's the spark for something like that? What would it take to... I mean, it's almost like the formation of a sun from a cloud of gas. What becomes the trigger for that thing to collapse around a singularity and become?
Well, being a realist, what you want to do, as I said, get all those people in a room. And when I say all those people, I mean 20 of the top multimillionaire successful people who can do this at a heartbeat, and it wouldn't matter, it wouldn't interfere with what they're doing in their regular, everyday lives. They would just come together in a But the only way you can get them to come into that room, Mike, there's the rub. There's the problem. I can't do it. You couldn't do it. You've got to find somebody that they all know and respect. Have that, go to that person with the proposal and say to that person, and let's just use Magic Johnson as an example, and the reason I say Magic is they all love Magic. And if Magic picks up the phone and said, look, I'm having a meeting in my office, they are there, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
They are there with bells on, whereas they wouldn't be if somebody like a Magic Johnson. So then you get these people in one room, and you pitch this amazing thing that won't cost them a dime unless they want to invest in it. All it would cost them is the use of their successful leverage to start this company. And there are a lot of components that have to be in that, but in order to get it done, it's got to be somebody that they all respect that can call them and call a meeting in my office or at my house or around the pool, and they would come, you see, because it's Magic Johnson. And Magic is a big, tremendous success, but I don't know, everybody loves Magic. I don't know anybody that doesn't love Magic. But so those...
Well, maybe from your mouth to his ears.
Well, if he's listening, call me, or let me call you. And I got to be honest with you, Mike. I'm already, this is already in a proposal form.
Cool.
And I am just waiting for the right time to make that move. So I know exactly what it's going to take. And
that's
it can
exciting.
Happen if the right people are involved. And so that's my dream, to see something like that. But I'm happy about where we are now. I love to see more diversity in television and film. I'd love to see more of that, and I think we're doing it. We're winning Academy Awards, and I think it's wonderful that they're producing more movies. James Baldwin's got a couple of movies last year and this year. James Baldwin is no longer with us, but right. I mean, his stories, his work, his poetry, his characters, his drama, that is now being done, whereas before, it wasn't being done.
Let me do a quick station ID. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM. My guest is actor, director, producer, visionary, DC hero Robert Hooks, my brother-in-law, in full disclosure. you can go to kpft.org and find out what's happening at this station. Support the station by clicking on the donate button. You can find out about events, personalities, about the various shows. Many programs have links to websites, including mine at thinkwingradio.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at thinkwingradio. So we're kind of down to like the last 10 minutes here. Do you want to talk about... I know you're a political junkie. Do we want to digress into just kind of what you see coming up over the next 12 months?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
that's what you've been waiting for the whole discussion, right?
No, 10 minutes is gone. I mean, but I'm as happy as a lark, Mike, as to how we are now making some leeway to correct the amazing, amazing wrongs that have been done since this president's been in office for 2+ years.
Actually, it's less than 2 years. It just seems longer.
It seems longer, and I was hoping that it wouldn't last as long as it's lasting. But I think Robert Mueller has some surprises for everybody when he makes his report to Congress and to the Supreme Court. And I think where we're going, politically, I think that what has pleased me more than anything were the midterm results. And the fact that we're going to take back control of the House of Representatives. I'm happy that Nancy Pelosi is going to remain or redo the speakership.
Yeah, you know, I think it's worth noting that anyone that Republicans keep complaining about is probably someone that Democrats should embrace.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they're afraid of, they're so afraid of Nancy Pelosi, you would not believe it. But it's not going to be Nancy. Nancy's going to, you know, she's just the leader, right? But or the speaker, who is the leader, of course. But no, it's these guys, these people, guys and girls that she's putting on these committees, like the
Adam Phipps.
And, you know, I mean, they're going to really and truly expose these last, well, under 2 years for what they really are. And that's like a criminal enterprise is what's happening at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C.,
It's the RICO White House.
That's right. That's the White House, right? I know because I'm a Washingtonian, so I even
that's
know the
right.
zip code.
There you go. What is the zip code?
I'm sorry?
What is the zip code of the White House?
20001 or something like that.
Wow.
I was joking when I said that. You had to put you had to
I had well, you know, you made the claim, play the game.
Yeah, no, I think it's that, but I mean, look, it's we know it's 1600, and they're in deep trouble over there. It's an ice box, and it's a swamp. But anyway, once that is, once we are in, get those hearings going, and once we start dealing with the whole issue of gerrymandering and the issues that I know that the Democrats are anxious to deal with as they control now the House.
Voter suppression, Voting Rights Act.
I'm going to be talking with you. And incidentally, let me say that I am so proud to be your brother-in-law.
Oh,
so proud.
Well, me too.
Yeah, yeah. Your sister is just the
we're just a mutual admiration society.
Catch me out. I just took a picture of the cat sitting on her lap.
Has the conversation gotten now to family cats?
But I think we're in pretty good shape, and I think for 2020, Mike. And I see, I'm looking down the pike at that. I think we can win, take back the Senate, because these people have been such enablers for this man who has just turned everything upside down that I think we have a very, very good shot at winning both houses, winning the Senate, keeping the House, and taking over the White House, because I cannot fathom another Republican sitting in that Oval Office.
You know, in my last
another two decades.
In my last show, we talked about Elizabeth Warren, who was recently announced, and
right.
You know, it's so early to be doing a thumbs up or thumbs down on anybody.
I wouldn't do
you know,
that.
The guess is that there are probably going to be 20 plus Democrats that are going to take a shot at the presidential nomination.
Yeah, and there'll be some good ones. And I respect the Democrats enough. I'm a liberal. I'm a liberal Democrat. I respect them enough to that we will come out with the best nominee for 2020.
I think the Democrats have an uncommonly deep bench of talent.
Oh, we do.
I don't know that I've seen that much potential talent in one group of potential candidates in my lifetime.
In a long time, probably my lifetime as well. I'm older than you are, but no, I think our bench is strong. And I think we can. I can be happy with I'm thinking. You say 20. I can be happy with who comes out of that.
Yeah, I think whoever comes out, I'll be pleased with.
Exactly, and I'm that confident that it will be the best person for us in 2020. I don't know what's going to happen on the other side. I could care less about whatever happens to Republicans. I could care less, but I do know that we are ready now to take back. And fix this. The democracy has just been swallowed up by these vultures. And
there's going to have to be legislation, maybe constitutional amendments. Norms are going to have to be codified. We can't assume that people will simply do the right thing anymore. We've been shown that they will exploit every opportunity. At least some people will. And we can't let that happen again.
No, we can't let it happen again. It's already happened and is happening. But we can't let it happen again, and I think we can. I'm happy with where we are right now after the midterm elections. I'm happy looking forward into 2020. 2019 is going to be one hot firecracker up on the hill,
I
can tell you that.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting year.
Yes.
So, Happy New Year.
I'm going to be all over it from my television, of course.
It'll almost become fun watching the news again, maybe.
Yeah. I'm going to go back to watching the news. Last time I talked to you, I stopped watching the news.
I know.
Except 2 hours a night when I'm watching Rachel and Lawrence.
That's me. And I have to say, on Sundays, I watch KCDC because I need to know if there's something going on for the weekend that I need to keep an eye on for my Monday show.
Yeah, I wish I could be that strong, but I just can't.
I have to, you know, sometimes I joke on my show that I watch the news so you don't have to.
Right, exactly. But I'll go back to it because I tell you, this is going to be some very, very interesting happenings in the hearings that are coming forth. And I just can't wait for us to start exposing this wrongdoing that's been happening over the last 2 years.
Yeah, it's going to be almost like the fourth act in a play, isn't it?
It is. It really is. And it's a tragedy. And we're going to fix it where we can make it hopefully start moving out of the darkness into the light come January.
Hopefully a happy ending.
Next week.
Is there anyone, we've got about 3 or 4 minutes, is there any one or two or three people that you, sort of top of mind for you, that you would like to see run?
To see run?
As president?
Yeah. I must tell you that I am so taken with that young man in Texas, Beto O'Rourke.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to see him somewhere, whether it's on the second part of a ticket. I don't know about the first. It's a little too early for me right now. I like Kamala. I like Elizabeth. But it's a little too early right now for me. I don't. There's an Amy Klobuchar, I think, down the line that might throw her hat in, too, and I really like her. Bernie, I don't even think Bernie is going to end up running, but he might try to throw his hat. But he's an independent. He's not a Democrat. So, I'm just looking at the Democrats right now.
I actually have wondered about Adam Schiff.
Now, see, I love Adam Schiff. He's my congressman, my district, my congressman.
And he,
I saw him when he was, you know, when he wasn't even in Washington. He was here in city council. But I like him, but I don't, I think it's a little too early. He may go on somebody's ticket.
Well, I see him as being very well versed in foreign affairs, and I think we have a lot of patching up to do.
We do. We really do. I like him a lot. I think Adam is one of our top Democrats that I respect more than others. So I really like him. I agree with you 100% on Adam Schiff.
Yeah, just an enormous number of possibilities. You know, I might have specific policy differences with some of them, but all of them look so promising.
Yeah, and I, you know, even Bernie. I mean, when Bernie was running against Hillary, I mean, I said, look, if it's Bernie, fine, I'll go with Bernie. I am Hillary, but I'll go with Bernie. So we have such a great team that'll be in the running, and you know, like you say, the bench is strong. So I think we're okay for 2020.
What is the name of that show? The Kids Are Okay.
The Kids Are Okay, right?
The Kids Are Okay. All right, I think that about wraps it up for us. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. In Houston, my guest has been Robert Hooks, my brother-in-law, a director, producer, theater company creator, Washington, D.C. honoree, and a man who's had really an amazing personal and professional history. It's just this show doesn't even begin to do it justice.
I appreciate it, Mike. I was happy to do it.
Well, I'm going to have stuff on my webpage for this show, and hopefully people will click on links and learn a whole lot more about what you've accomplished in your life. It really is quite remarkable.
Well, thank you for allowing me to sit down with you, my friend.
Well, it's been my pleasure. So I will speak to you folks, my audience, next week. It should be a call-in show again. And I thank you all for listening and hope you've enjoyed it. Have a great week. Bye-bye. And I think at that point they will just cut it.
Oh, okay. So you've got some editing to do and go knock yourself. Was that okay?
I think it was okay. I want to know what you think, actually.
Oh, no, I liked it. I enjoyed it.
Okay, because I know
you have a lot to choose from, so just edit nicely. And, I was happy with the coverage that we had.
Yeah, because we had a lot of discussion about what you wanted to be able to talk about and where you felt the legacy and focus of your life was, and
We touched on all of that.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Good.
Okay, all right, so I've got to make some dinner. We have to make some decisions for dinner, and then tomorrow I have some black eyed peas and greens that I'm going to be taking over to Kevin's. We're doing the New Year's Day football kind of thing, so Lori and I will be going over there. So I've made a big, nice pot of black eyed peas and a pot of greens.
Do you know the legend of why black eyed peas?
My New Year's contribution.
Do you know why the legend of why black eyed peas are considered good luck in the South for New Year's?
Why?
Because.
Dar la bienvenida al extranjero es un asunto moral que se encuentra en muchas tradiciones espirituales. La gente de Houston da la bienvenida a todos aquellos que quieren emigrar a los Estados Unidos. Exigimos leyes humanas de inmigración que respeten los derechos y la dignidad de todas las personas. Por favor, reunirse en el Ayuntamiento de Houston el 15 de diciembre a las 11 de la mañana.
If you decided to donate your birthday to KPFT this year, thank you. If your special day hasn't yet arrived, consider donating your birthday to KPFT. Here's how it works. Facebook sends you a prompt before your birthday asking if you'd like to donate your birthday to a nonprofit. Select KPFT as your organization of choice. Then add a personalized message so that your friends know how much KPFT means to you. On your birthday, they'll receive a Facebook notification asking them to make a donation in your honor to KPFT. Thanks again for supporting 90.1 FM KPFT Houston, Pacifica Radio for Peace.